Welcome to the Cancer Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question and answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Sam, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Connect workshop, and it's Living with Colorectal Cancer. It's a two-part series, and today's program focuses on management of metastatic colorectal cancer. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and it is because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. Now, we have on the call today over 743 participants on the call, and you come from all over the United States, from all different regions of the United States. And we also have international participants from Australia, Brazil, Canada, China, Germany, Ireland, and the United Kingdom. So it's a global call. You're really from all over the world. And it's a credit to each of you that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us to learn more about the management of metastatic colorectal cancer. This program was made possible by Bayer Healthcare Pharmaceuticals, Genentech, a member of the Roche Group, and Bristol-Myers Squibb, and Spectrum Pharmaceuticals, Inc. And I really want to thank all of these companies for their support of this program today, for their collaborative and partnership in making this program possible. Now, I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials that we received from Cancer Care. In those materials is information about our speakers, topics they'll be addressing, and all the different collaborating organizations as a resource for you to contact. In addition, there is an evaluation form, and I'd ask you to take a moment at the end of today's program and complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you can best tell us the topics that you'd like us to offer going forward? We are at the beginning of a year of 2013, and we're planning many programs going forward, and indeed your suggestions really help to tailor the programs to best meet your needs. Indeed, today's workshop title is one that many of you have asked us to offer, so we try very much to accommodate to what you ask us to do. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Leonard Saltz. And Dr. Saltz is Chief Gastrointestinal Oncology Service, Head Colorectal Oncology Section, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Dr. Saltz is going to address an overview of metastatic colorectal cancer and current standard of care, new treatment approaches, the role of personalized medicine. He's also going to address clinical trials and how research contributes to treatment options, practical tips to manage side effects and pain, treatment options to manage liver metastases, and communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Saltz.
Hello, everybody. It's a pleasure to have a chance to talk with you today. What I'm going to try to do in the next 20-25 minutes or so is bring everybody up to the same level in terms of understanding of metastatic colorectal cancer and what we do to try to help it. I'm going to be defining a lot of terms, and so those of you that already understand some of these definitions, please bear with me, but I want to make sure that everybody understands what we're talking about. The term metastatic is often misunderstood. When we talk about a metastatic cancer, what we mean is a cancer that started in one place and has spread to somewhere else. So if a cancer starts in the colon or rectum and it spreads to another place in the body, the most common sites being the liver or the lung, that would be metastatic colorectal cancer. Within the context of metastatic colorectal cancer, it breaks down into two basic categories. One that we use the term oligometastatic disease. Oligo means a small number. A small number of metastatic sites versus a more diffuse metastatic cancer, and the difference being that when there's a small area or a small number of metastatic sites, sometimes surgery comes into play to try to remove those sites. That's the relative minority or smaller amount of patients with metastatic colorectal cancer. The majority have disease that cannot effectively be removed with an operation, and therefore the standard treatment is chemotherapy. Now, chemotherapy is just a big word for drugs. As you all know, doctors like big words. And what we're talking about when we say chemotherapy is using drugs that are designed to kill cancer cells. Unfortunately, the differences between cancer cells and normal cells are not as great as we would like them to be, and therefore all chemotherapy drugs have the potential to kill some normal cells, and that leads to side effects. And we'll talk about side effects in a moment. We often talk about what is current standard treatment or the standard of care. When you deal with a disease like colorectal cancer, there are many different standard options. And so one person with colorectal cancer may talk to another, either in social interaction or in the waiting room or whatever, and find out that they're on different chemotherapies or different treatment strategies from each other. That can be confusing. I think it's important to understand that there's no one therapy that's clearly proven to be the one right answer for everybody. And therefore, many people will be on different therapies along the way. When we talk about chemotherapy, the drug that often comes into play is an old drug called 5-fluorouracil, often abbreviated 5-FU. This is a drug that was patented in 1957. And it's embarrassing to people like me who spend a lot of time trying to come up with better drugs that it's still one of the very best ones we have. And so if you are or know someone who is being treated for metastatic colorectal cancer, high likelihood that 5-FU or 5-fluorouracil is part of that treatment. It's a drug that's given a number of different ways. We used to tend to give it by just a short injection or what's called bolus, but now we usually give it as an infusion over a day or two, and the most common regimens give it as a 48-hour infusion every other week. It's often given with a vitamin called leucovorin. Leucovorin is also known as folinic acid, and that may sound familiar to you as sounding very much like folic acid, which is part of a regular vitamin tablet. Folinic acid is just a slight chemical variation of folic acid, and by itself it doesn't do anything, but it makes the 5-FU bind a little bit more tightly to its target enzyme and makes the drug a little bit more effective. We also use other drugs. One is called irinotecan and the other oxaliplatin. And when we put them together with the folinic acid and the 5-FU, we often come up with regimens that go by their acronyms. One is called FOLFOX and one is called FOLFIRI. Again, these are terms people often hear thrown around and may not have familiarity with what exactly they mean. So FOLFOX and FOLFIRI are two different chemotherapy combinations that are given to patients with metastatic colorectal cancer. The folinic acid, the second F-fluorouracil, the oxaliplatin, and the irinotecan. And you can appreciate with the names of these drugs being so ridiculously long that using these short acronyms is convenient. When we use these drugs in metastatic colorectal cancer, there are a number of different goals. Of course, the most important goal is we're trying to help people live as long as possible, and studies have shown that these drugs are able to help people live longer. How to tell how much benefit any one individual is going to get from a treatment is impossible at this point. It's something that we are hoping to be able to get better at over time. So we never really focus too much on how long is this drug going to help me as an individual. What we focus on is whatever my situation is as an individual, how can we make it the best that it can possibly be? How can we use the drugs available to us in order to control the cancer for as long as possible? Now, the other thing that we like to see with chemotherapy drugs is the ability to shrink the tumors, and we use the term response to define a tumor that's shrinking or responding. And all of these chemotherapies to varying degrees have the ability to do that. If people are having symptoms from the tumor, if the tumor is causing pain or blocking something that shouldn't be blocked, shrinking that tumor becomes very important because in doing so, we can alleviate those symptoms. Now, FOLFOX and FOLFIRI are the two most commonly used combinations of chemotherapy. Studies have shown that they're equally effective, and therefore it's perfectly reasonable to start patients on one treatment or the other. But the side effect profiles are different. The major side effects that we see with FOLFOX and other oxaliplatin-based chemotherapies is what's called a neuropathy. And the neuropathy is a numbness or tingling in the hands and feet, and a cold sensitivity in the hands, the feet, and the throat. And this is something we really have to watch carefully as we're treating our patients, because what we've learned is that there can be what's called a coasting phenomenon, which means that the problem keeps building even after we've stopped the treatment. So from the time that we stop oxaliplatin until the time that the side effect of the neuropathy gets to its worst level or peaks can be as long as 3 to 4 months. So if we wait for a patient to say, now this neuropathy is really bothering me, we've waited too long, because the potential is that it's going to become problematic later on. And so we need to be having a constant dialogue, doctor and patient, about the side effects, how much they're bothering the person, how long they're lasting, and decisions made on when to either reduce or discontinue the dose of the oxaliplatin. Now, with the FOLFIRI regimen using irinotecan instead of oxaliplatin, the major side effect difference is that there isn't neuropathy. There's no neuropathy in the FOLFIRI regimen. However, hair loss is a much more common problem with FOLFIRI than with FOLFOX. And that matters to differing degrees to different people. For some people, how they look and feel, how they look has a lot to do with how they feel, and keeping a sense of self-esteem and comfort with one's looks is an important part of coping with chemotherapy. For other people, they're trying to maintain privacy, either for personal or professional reasons, and of course hair loss can be a problem there. And so we shouldn't belittle this as an important side effect, but rather we need to talk with each individual patient and discuss whether or not this is a side effect that matters to him or her. It's been my experience that some people find surprising, I don't, that hair loss seems to matter more to my male patients than a lot of my female patients, for various different reasons. But of course, everyone's an individual, and any one individual, it may or may not be important. All of the chemotherapies have the potential ability to cause nausea and vomiting. And of course, that's one of the most feared complications of chemotherapy. And it's probably that fear of nausea and vomiting that makes chemotherapy such a scary word. One of the most important advances in the last 30 years in cancer therapy is the dramatic improvement in anti-nausea therapy. And so, fortunately, nowadays, most patients are treated with very aggressive anti-nausea medicines before they get this regimen or these regimens, and the majority of people will not experience major problems with nausea or vomiting on this treatment. Now, of course, there are always some people who have more of one side effect than another. We don't understand why that is, and so nausea and vomiting can be a problem, and if you're an individual or know an individual with that, well, yes, we certainly do see that. But for the majority of people, it's become a minor issue. These drugs can make people feel tired, usually just for the first few days after the administration of the drugs, and they're typically given on an every other week schedule, so that many patients tell us that they want to get treated late in the week so they can take it easy over the weekend and then go to work the following week. And it's not uncommon that many of our patients are able to handle a pretty close to a normal work schedule on chemotherapy. Now, over the past decade or so, some other drugs have come into play, and they've been added onto the drugs that I've already talked about. One drug is called bevacizumab, or goes under the trade name Avastin, and it's a drug that by itself doesn't really have activity in colorectal cancer, but studies have shown that adding it to chemotherapy regimens gives us a modest but real improvement in outcome. Another class of drugs inhibit a certain growth factor receptor, and these drugs go by the names cetuximab and panitumumab, or by brand name they're called Erbitux or Vectibix. They're two very, very similar drugs, they are able to shrink the tumors in patients who have a certain type of colorectal cancer. So we've learned to look at the tumor from a genetic point of view, determine whether there are mutations that will interfere with these drugs working or not, and on the basis of the mutation in a particular protein you may have heard of called KRAS, we can determine if these drugs make sense to use or not. None of these drugs are as good as we need them to be. All of these are drugs that add something to patient care, and we're constantly looking for better alternatives. One attempt to improve on this treatment is a drug called capecitabine or Xeloda. It really isn't different from 5-FU, but it's oral. And so for some patients, that offers an advantage because that particular drug can be taken as pills rather than as an intravenous infusion. More recently, two newer drugs have come on the market. One is called aflibercept or Zaltrap. It's a drug that is similar to bevacizumab or Avastin in terms of its target. The data suggest that when it's given as a part of a second-line treatment, it has a very similar effect to continuing Avastin in the second line. The concern I have about it is it doesn't seem to offer a whole lot of new benefit because it's working in the same scenario where the older drug was working. I have a higher comfort level with a drug that's been around for a decade than with something new, so I've been tending to use that one more. And as Ian and my colleagues here at Sloan Kettering have written about in a number of venues, we've been concerned because the price of aflibercept is virtually double that of bevacizumab or Avastin, and for that reason we've not been using it as it doesn't seem to offer any benefit and costs more. Some doctors have been using it around the country. It is FDA approved, and so you may encounter that. The most recent drug to become available for patients with colorectal cancer is regorafenib, goes by the trade name Stivarga. It's a pill, and studies showed that it did have the ability to help patients live longer. On average, the benefit was very modest, 1.4-month survival benefit over a sugar pill in randomized studies. But what was important is that when we looked at the breakdown of those studies, there were clearly a group of patients that got no benefit from the drug, and then clearly a group of patients that seemed to get a more substantial benefit. So our challenge is going to be to try to figure out who these people are. And that brings us to the concept of a term that you hear thrown around a lot, personalized medicine. We know that colorectal cancer really isn't one disease. It's many, many diseases, maybe even hundreds of different diseases. And what we're trying to do is understand on a molecular basis what makes the tumor tick, what are its vulnerabilities, and how can we best attack that tumor in each individual patient. So we are doing an analysis of each metastatic colorectal cancer that we treat at our institution and are looking for genetic vulnerabilities. To some degree, we've been stymied in this approach because what we've tended to find is more explanations why certain drugs will not work. So, for example, I mentioned the KRAS gene earlier. KRAS is a gene that has a mutation in about 40% of patients with colorectal cancer. If the KRAS gene is normal, or what we call wild type, or not mutated, then we know those patients have a chance to potentially benefit from drugs like cetuximab or panitumumab, or Erbitux or Vectibix. However, if the mutation is present in that gene, we know that the drugs won't work in those patients, and therefore we can save them the side effects, the expense, and the disappointment of being treated with a drug that doesn't work. Similarly, we would hope to be able to find such markers for a drug like regorafenib or Stivarga, this new agent that seems to offer benefit but to a subset of patients. Obviously, if we could define that subset in advance and say, you're the patient that has a really good chance of benefiting, let's go with this drug, versus your patient that we can tell this drug won't work, so let's not take the risk of the side effects, that would be a really nice step forward. Of course, what we would really like is markers that open up new personalized avenues. So, for example, a marker that says, because of this mutation profile, these drugs that don't work in most colon cancers and wouldn't be thought of as colon cancer drugs might work in your cancer. That's what we hope to get to in personalized medicine, is bringing new personal options to individuals. Unfortunately, we're not there yet. work continues, but we don't really have the ability to identify reasons to believe that any particular drug will work or not. There are a lot of commercial assays that are out there that purport to be able to do this, but unfortunately, they really haven't, in our opinion, panned out. And I don't use them, and we don't use them at Sloan Kettering, and I don't advocate their use because I think they give a degree of false comfort and false hope in terms of recommending drugs, and we don't really have a sense that those recommendations are in fact beneficial to our patients. I want to move to the area of clinical trials because I was asked to discuss some issues about that and how research contributes to treatment options. A couple of things that are important to understand about clinical trials. Issue number one, you can never be part of a clinical trial without knowing it. And you can never be part of a clinical trial without giving your permission, both verbally and in writing. If you haven't signed written permission to participate in a clinical trial, then you are not on a clinical trial. It would be both unethical and illegal for that to be the case. Okay, so you never have to worry about that. In addition, if you do agree to participate in a clinical trial, you will be informed, both verbally and in writing, about what the possibilities are and what the issues are. You will not find that there is a hidden agenda. They can't say we're going to do this and do something else. So there's always clear communication between an investigator and a patient who agrees to participate in the study. And one of the things that I think we have to answer for our patients is, what's in it for you? Why does this make sense for you? Now, I really appreciate that sometimes patients will be very altruistic and say, I want to be part of a clinical trial because it might be good for mankind. And I often say, that's very nice. That's very noble. But with all respect, I think you have a responsibility to yourself and those people that care about you to be thinking about yourself and to be thinking, is this in your best interest? It's great if, as an aside, it's helpful to other people as well, but going through cancer treatment is very hard. You have a responsibility to yourself. And I strongly advocate that when people agree to go on a clinical trial, they should do so because they think that that's the best option for them. And that's the issue that I think you really need to explore with your doctor in terms of understanding, is this an option that I wish to avail myself of? Does this potentially have some upside that can help me do better, get better, whatever, because that's the goal for you, is figuring out the best treatment for you. Now, it's important to understand that if we knew something worked or knew it worked better, then it wouldn't be a clinical trial. A clinical trial is a legitimate question where we're saying we don't know what the answer is. The other thing I should mention to you about clinical trials is people often worry, well, might I not get the real drug? Might I get a placebo? And the answer is, only if it is a placebo-controlled study where half are getting real drug and half are getting placebo. And if that is the case, you must be told that, again, in writing and verbally, and you must give your permission for that. And only in situations where no treatment would be an option would placebo be considered. So you never need to be worried that you could wind up with a placebo and not know it, or wind up with a and not know that it was a possibility, or wind up with a placebo in a situation where there's clearly an effective drug that you should be getting. So I hope that clarifies some of the more common questions that come up about clinical trials. Whether on clinical trial or with standard therapy, of course, coping with side effects is one of the biggest challenges that our patients face. And different side effects have different controls. So a lot of our drugs, for example, cause diarrhea. There we can use a certain amount of practical changes in diet. What I'm always advising patients is, if you're not having diarrhea, there's no reason to worry about your diet. You can eat the food that you enjoy eating, and you can eat the food that you should be eating. If, however, you do get diarrhea, that would be a bad day to have a greasy fried meal. and that would be a bad day to go out and have a pepperoni pizza. That relatively easy to digest, non-greasy, non-spicy foods will help manage diarrhea. We often use standard over-the-counter treatments like Imodium or loperamide, and then we may have to make dose modifications once the diarrhea resolves. Other side effects, the neuropathy that I talked about before with oxaliplatin, the problem that we have there is we really don't have a good drug therapy for it. To my knowledge, there's no drug therapy that is truly helpful with the neuropathy, and what we have to do there is work to avoid it. So we have to work to control the amount of drug that people are exposed to limit it to just the amount that we need, to pull back on the drug if people are getting signs of progressing neuropathy, and to avoid exposing people to treatments that have their own side effects and are unlikely to work. So often people are recommended for drugs like Neurontin or Lyrica, which are used to treat other types of neuropathy, but they don't really have any demonstrated effectiveness on this type of heavy metal chemotherapy-induced neuropathy. The drugs have their own side effect profiles, and in our experience, they don't work, and we don't recommend those interventions for oxaliplatin neuropathy. I want to touch on the issue of management of liver metastasis, because this is, again, an issue that often comes up with patients. Can liver metastasis be removed surgically? The answer is in some people, but not in others. And when the disease is in the liver only, that's when it's important for oncologists and surgeons that are familiar with liver surgery to take a careful look at the scans and the patient and determine whether or not the pattern would allow for removal of all the cancer. If all the cancer can be safely removed from the liver, with enough healthy liver left for the person to be healthy, then that's a situation where we would recommend liver surgery. If there is cancer outside the liver, and or if there's cancer in all the different quadrants or zones of the liver such that you cannot remove all of it, then removing just pieces of it or debulking has not been shown to be helpful for patients, and therefore we don't usually recognize that. The last issue that I was asked to talk about today and that I want to make sure we cover is communicating with your healthcare team. I can't emphasize how much this is important and often underappreciated. Doctors need to know what's on a patient's mind, need to know what's on a family's mind. Often what we try to do is anticipate what are the common questions, what are the common problems, and try to discuss those. But we can never know all of the individual questions that somebody has. It's really important that you have a relationship with your doctor and with your other healthcare providers such that you feel comfortable asking questions. What I try to emphasize with patients at the first visit when we go over what our overall plans are going to be is that if they remember a quarter of what we talked about in that first visit, they're ahead of the game. It's usually a huge amount of information. It's very scary. Lots of new things to understand, and that they need to understand and we need to understand that we're going to go over this again and again, and they need to feel comfortable asking questions. And I emphasize to people, if you remember only one thing from this discussion, remember, when in doubt, ask. It's also important to keep paper and pen nearby or something more electronic if that's the way you do this, but write down your question the second you think of it. Because human nature is that you could forget it 20 minutes later, and certainly that you could forget it at a time when you do get a chance to speak with your doctor or nurse. And so it's really important to be able to get your questions organized in a way that we can try to address them. It's also important to bear in mind that not every question is answerable. There are an awful lot of questions out there for which the answer will be, we really don't know, or we can't tell for any one individual. We can talk about large populations. I usually discourage people from trying to pursue issues of percentages and expectations, because when people say, well, what is my chance of this or what is my chance of that, all we can do is say what happened for a population in a study. And that study has a very broad-based bell-shaped curve to it. And for any one individual, you can't tell where in that curve the person might fall. So while it's important to try to get as much information as you can and to try to communicate as clearly as you can with your healthcare team, it's also important to bear in mind that some of the most important questions are ones that only time will tell and that we don't have an answer. I think with that, I'm about out of the time that I was allotted, so I'm going to stop there and let the other speakers go, and then we'll all come back and take questions later.
Thank you very much, Dr. Salz, for just a really an extraordinary presentation and for really covering lots of information about the management and treatment for metastatic colorectal cancer. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, and I thank you for this really comprehensive presentation, very informative as well. Our next speaker is Diana Bearden. And Ms. Bearden is a supervisor for clinical nutrition at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Ms. Bearden is going to address nutritional concerns and tips. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Ms. Bearden.
Thank you, Carolyn. I'm here to discuss some common side effects and ways to manage that with nutrition that you may experience while going through treatment. Some of the things that I encourage patients to remember is we need to start with the diet that you're tolerating, where you are in your treatment. Your side effects are going to vary based on where you are and how you're reacting to your treatment. So not every patient will necessarily be given the same recommendations from their healthcare team. But some common experiences patients go through during their treatment are things like nausea and vomiting, a decreased appetite. Sometimes there are taste changes, mouth sores, diarrhea. And so meeting with your healthcare team and your dietitian, they can work with you on the best ways to address this and hopefully improve some of your symptoms. So some things to remember is in order to accomplish maintaining your weight and in maintaining a good nutritional status is to get the nutrition in that you need. And for some patients, eating several times throughout the day may be a suggestion you hear. Small meals throughout the day are an easy way to get in calories and your protein. Drinking plenty of fluids is very important as well, especially while you are under treatment, whether it's chemotherapy or radiation. And choosing foods that are going to be not only palatable and taste good and that you enjoy, but also have a nutritional significance as well. So if we were to look at some of the common side effects patients experience and how to manage that with your diet, starting with nausea and vomiting, for example, sometimes eliminating foods that have offending odors. This can mean switching to cold foods, foods that don't carry as much of a fragrance, maybe something that the patient responds to well. Always keeping something on your stomach or with you. Sometimes just you don't realize it, but you go through the day and you may take your medication and you just don't feel like eating at that point, or you go and lay back down and you wake up and you feel nauseated. So keeping something like dry crackers or even toast to nibble on can be very helpful for patients. It's a bland option and doesn't have a lot of odors or spices to it, so it can be something that's well tolerated. Also avoiding things that are overly sweet, greasy, or fried, or even highly seasoned foods. And sometimes this can be a challenge if your regular diet includes a lot of spices and herbs and things like that. It may require removing some of those foods from your product list, but at the same time, you'll see an improvement with your tolerance, hopefully. Eating food at room temperature can be very helpful as well, especially with helping eliminate some of the odors. And we'll talk a little bit more about this if experiencing diarrhea, but again, anything that can help remove some of those offending odors. And things may smell good to others and then not good to the patient. If you're experiencing a poor appetite or feeling full quickly, which a lot of patients do experience, the small frequent meals would be something we would encourage. And at the same time with the poor appetite, again, it's finding nutrient-dense foods, which means foods that contain maybe higher calories in a smaller volume to help that patient get the nourishment and the calories they need without having to eat a large volume of food. Another thing that can help is being relaxed as possible during meal times, wearing comfortable clothing. That may be something that sounds basic, but sometimes we forget that we're rushing and going and running to appointments, and sometimes just sitting down to eat isn't always possible, but trying to do that as often as possible is recommended. Sometimes medication may be indicated, and talking with your healthcare team about this is important. Not everybody is appropriate for something like this, but it's definitely something you may hear about from other patients or read about, and so always dialoguing with your healthcare team before trying something on your own is very important, primarily for the interactions that you're not aware of with some of the medications you're receiving. If you are experiencing changes in your taste, one thing to consider is keeping good oral hygiene. We encourage patients a lot of times to rinse their mouth between different foods they might be eating to cleanse their palate. And sometimes just monitoring your hydration can be important in accomplishing your mouth care as well. Some patients go a very long time or don't drink a lot and they have diarrhea or they're vomiting and they're becoming dehydrated quickly. Another common taste change is that patients may sense a taste like a metallic taste. And if this is your situation, switching to plasticware or using glassware is important to transition over to. That can have an effect, and avoiding foods that are in cans and drinking out of cans can help with this as well. If you're having a dull, everything's tasting dull and bland, a lot of things that work for patients are, if you're not having the mouth sores, that is, things that are a little bit more tart. So lemons, vinegar, pickles, sometimes using marinades can be an easy way to incorporate this in preparing your foods. And also, trying foods that you previously didn't like. This sounds a little peculiar and things you may not think about doing, but changes in taste are very common. And so at one point in your life, you may not have cared for a certain product, and go ahead and try it and see how it works. You may be surprised. If you're experiencing mouth sores, which can be very uncomfortable and limiting as well, talk with your doctor about your medications. There are some things you can do for swishes and rinses and things like that to help the area and allow you to be able to eat more comfortably. Choosing soft, moist foods that are easy to swallow is a recommendation that we often provide patients. Therefore, avoiding any rough textured foods like chips and things that could be uncomfortable if they were to be in your mouth and rub against a sore. Avoiding foods that are acidic or tart and spicy that can be irritating to your mouth. And helping with just the chewing process, cutting your food into small bites or maybe pureeing. I mean, it's rarely necessary to puree anything, but if you're really uncomfortable, that may be an option. And again, practicing, I can't reemphasize enough, but practicing good oral hygiene is important. Diarrhea is another common side effect that patients experience, and it depends on the source of the diarrhea as to how you will address it in the diet. So it's not one blanket suggestion. It depends a lot of times if it's a radiation induced, if it's a chemotherapy induced. So definitely talking with your healthcare team about how to manage the diarrhea. Sometimes, medications can be a first-line approach potentially. And then, if that's not helpful enough, then modifying your diet may be required as well. But things that typically enhance or makes the diarrhea worse are sugar alcohols, things that are in sugar-free foods, or drinking a lot of sweetened are eating a lot of sweetened foods or drinking a lot of sweetened beverages. This can actually exacerbate the diarrhea as well. Fiber can be something that may need to be manipulated depending on, you know, what's going on and what's the cause of the diarrhea. So if you are having diarrhea, some key things that we do encourage patients to do is stay hydrated. Very important. This may require an electrolyte type replacement in your fluids, but talk with your healthcare team about that, and they'll be able to guide you on the appropriate selections to make. I think that covers the common side effects and the nutrition intervention, so I'm going to hand it back over to Carolyn.
Well, thank you very much, Diana, for an excellent, really, presentation. And there's lots of tips for people. I know Dr. Saltz had mentioned earlier, this is a big area for people, lots of concerns about this issue, and I think that you really helped address a lot of concerns and give a lot of very practical tips, so thank you. And our next presenter is Elizabeth Ezra. And Ms. Ezra is Program Coordinator for Cancer Care, and she is a colleague and friend of mine at Cancer Care, and she is going to address the free psychosocial services offered by Cancer Care, and she's also going to address colorectal cancer support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Ms. Ezra.
Thank you, Carolyn. I am an oncology social worker, and I work with many people with colorectal cancer and their loved ones. I would like to begin by speaking about the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed with cancer and how cancer care can be a part of that network. There are many ways we can help. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Cancer Care's programs, including individual counseling, support groups, either over the telephone or online, education about resources, and how to navigate the healthcare system, practical help, and some limited financial assistance, as well as chemo copay assistance, are provided by licensed master's level oncology social workers and are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends. They are also trained to help cancer patients and their families tackle the problems that accompany the disease, such as the financial demands, the physical changes, social adjustments, and the psychological impact and care. Adjusting to and dealing with the diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. Cancer affects the whole person and the entire family. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. Joining a support group is a way to connect with others who are going through a similar situation or have similar problems. These connections help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. Support groups are a safe place where you can voice your concerns and your fears. Feeling well emotionally can help you better deal with the diagnosis and the treatment. At this time, Cancer Care offers a people with colorectal support group over the phone, as well as online groups with people with colorectal cancer and their caregivers. We also have unique young adult caregivers group online. If you are interested in any of Cancer Care services, please call our Hope Line at 1-800-813-4673 or visit our website at www.cancercare.org. Our website is a very comprehensive, and you can find a lot of additional information on your cancer diagnosis and the treatment you need to receive. As we have learned a lot today from today's program, there's a lot of information to digest and to get your arms around. Our social workers can help you understand what it means for you and your family. Just as Dr. Saltz talked about communication, it's important to communicate those feelings with someone who may not be burdened by what you have to say and may be able to offer a unique perception on how things can continue and be more helpful. Your social worker can help you prioritize and actually rehearse the questions you might want to ask to get to the information and the information you need. please remember that you are not alone. Cancer Care Services are there to help you. Thank you for your attention and the opportunity to talk to you today. Thanks, Carolyn.
Well, thank you very much, Liz, for a wonderful presentation. Just wonderful, and also to let everyone know about all these services that you can access for free. And call us when you need services. You don't have to wait till you absolutely need them. You can call a little ahead of time, or you can call when you're in the midst of a problem, but you can also call ahead of time to get these services. And now we have time for questions. We have a lot of time for questions, and I'm going to ask Sam to bring on all of our speakers. And joining us will be Dr. David Ryan, Chief Division of Hematology Oncology, Clinical Director, Massachusetts General Hospital Cancer Center, Director, Tucker Gosnell Center for Gastrointestinal Cancers, Associate Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School. So we have all of our speakers on board now, and we have questions, and we'll take as many questions as we can. If we don't get your question, please call Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE, and I'll repeat that number again when the call concludes. Sam?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Those of you on the web, you may submit your questions by clicking Ask a Question. Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you do have a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone telephone.
So we have a question from one of our online participants, and actually the question is, I'm going to ask Dr. Ryan if you could address this question. It's about patients who are receiving irinotecan and have diarrhea, and what would be considered toxicity based on their stool output level. In other words, what are your recommendations for their stool output in grading their level of risk for dehydration, electrolyte abnormalities, et cetera? So if you could address this question in a general way, and I hope this will help our participant.
Sure. So irinotecan is known to cause diarrhea. Oftentimes, the way we give it now on an every two-week basis, the diarrhea is brief in duration, short-lived, that is, and occurs usually either as a component of the treatment, in which case much of that effect can be blocked by the nurses in the infusion unit, or about a week afterwards. And it comes on as often explosive, watery diarrhea up to several times in a day. We typically tell people to take Imodium to control that diarrhea, usually 1 to 2 tablets at the start, and then every hour thereafter until it stops. I have to say, since going to the every two-week regimen that Dr. Saltz described with FOLFIRI, the acronym that we use for 5-fluorouracil and irinotecan, it usually is not that severe. We as physicians begin to get concerned about dehydration when people have about more than 5 or 6 bowel movements per day, or that is of watery diarrhea more than 5 to 6 times a day, or if it's happening multiple days in a row, in which case we want them to come into clinic and be evaluated and perhaps get some hydration.
Thank you. And Dr. Saltz, do you want to add anything? Or
I think Dr. Ryan summed it up very well, that irinotecan, when it first started to be used, garnered a reputation for very severe diarrhea, probably because we were using it on a weekly schedule. It made perfect sense at the time. We just didn't know better. It turns out that when you move it to an every other week schedule, and it's a higher dose every other week, but just the way that the body metabolizes it makes it much more tolerable. So I don't think of it in the current context as that much more associated with diarrhea than some of our other drugs, such as 5-FU. It's just that it has that reputation, so it's hard to divorce those in our minds. As far as the management, it's really a matter of keeping up with the fluids. We don't want patients to get dehydrated. So to some degree, if you're able to take in more fluid than you're putting out, then that's manageable. And if there's any doubt about that whatsoever, it's important to get medical attention, because if somebody is at risk for dehydrating, if we get to them early, it's a matter of getting an outpatient liter or two of of intravenous fluid in the emergency room or the outpatient treatment area and sending them home, whereas if we wait longer, they can wind up being inpatients and having much more serious problems, and we obviously want to get to that problem early. It's also important to understand that when we talk about diarrhea, we're talking about liquid watery stool. I've had patients tell me I'm having diarrhea, and then as we interview and discuss further, what they're really having is a lot of frequent bowel movements, but they're formed stool. That's just something that does happen sometimes after colon surgery or after effect of certain chemotherapies, but there's no danger in that. It's just inconvenient.
Excellent. Thank you. And our next question, Sam?
Our next question comes from Mary M. Your line is now open.
Is this me?
Oh, hi, Mary, and we'd love to have your question.
Yes, I am Mary M., and I live in Buffalo, New York. And my question is, I've been in remission for 5 years, and I did have the oxaliplatin. I have extreme nerve damage, basically in my feet, and I've tried numerous things, including physical therapy. No, I didn't do the Neurontin. But I have not found anything to help. I have heard of a Rebuilder 310s unit. Do you know if that would be of any help?
Okay, well, thank you for that question. We're 5 years remission. We're good to hear that. We'll try to see if we can help you with your other concerns. Dr. Ryan, would you like to address this question in a general way?
Sure. So whenever we have somebody with neuropathy after oxaliplatin, generally speaking, time heals most people in the sense that roughly 80% of folks with neuropathy will have it resolve over the course of 12 to 18 months. But it remains very difficult for about 15 to 20% of people, and in a subset of those folks, it can be really a disabling side effect. Typically, for those folks, I like to get a neurology consult, if possible, just to make sure that there's nothing contributing to the neuropathy, such as diabetes or thyroid dysfunction or B12 deficiency. There are these other medical conditions that can cause neuropathy as well, and sometimes it's good to see a neurologist just to make sure that it is due to the oxaliplatin and not due to something else that's contributing. There are several medications that people will try to mitigate the effects of the neuropathy, particularly when it's painful. When it's just numb and tingly, these medications really don't have much of an effect. But for people with a painful neuropathy where it feels like their hands or feet are on fire, there are some medications that can be useful, and it's good to work with your physicians to sometimes try one medication after another, because the first medication you try might not work all that well or might have some side effects that don't make it all that well tolerable for you.
Thank you. Oh, excellent. And Dr. Saltz, did you want to add anything to that as well?
I'll just again agree. We have a very similar view on the situation and a very similar approach, that it's important in that, 10 to 15% of people where the neuropathy seems to be very long-lived or permanent, to make sure that there aren't other causes. And again, the distinction that Dr. Ryan made is exactly on target, that painful neuropathy is actually rare with oxaliplatin, very rare. But in those circumstances, then the drugs that I mentioned before, Lyrica, Neurontin, and sometimes Cymbalta, have had reports of benefits with individuals. And under the guidance of a neurologist that understands these drugs, I think it's worth a try. But most people have a numbness, a tingling, loss of position sense, so that they're stumbling or falling. Those are very, very frustrating, but unfortunately they're not helped with any drug or treatment that I'm aware of. I have heard people doing investigations of the TEMS-type therapy that you asked about and other type of mechanical or electrical interventions. I haven't seen any published data yet to tell me that that's effective. So we're always hopeful that somebody's going to have a new idea, but there's nothing that's out there that is validated as being useful.
And I want to thank you, Mary, for asking that wonderful question, because it's so important. I have to say that we have done programs just specifically on neuropathy in general, And I'll call you after the call if you're interested, but we have them both on telephone replay and also on our website for you to listen to them. And for some of those programs, we've used a doctor of rehabilitation medicine more to help with just compensating for some of the just in terms of walking and stability and things like that, really a lot of excellent tips that are presented in that venue. So please feel free to take advantage of those other programs as well. And remind me also that we should be offering another program soon on this topic. It is a very important one. I want to thank all of you really for, I want to thank our speakers, first of all, for just being so amazing in terms of the presentations. And I also want to thank all of you who've asked such excellent questions. And I want to remind all of you, this is a one-hour program, and that in planning a program like this, we recognize that you have many issues that go far beyond the scope of a one-hour program. And so we do these programs in conjunction, of course, with Cancer Care, and want you to know that although the program will soon end, the services that you can access from Cancer Care, those are kind of endless. They'll continue way after this program ends. And as Liz had said, we don't want anyone to leave this program feeling that you're alone. We want you to know that you're part of a community of support, and we're here to help you. We're simply a telephone call away at 1-800-813-HOPE, or you can visit our website at www.cancercare.org. But most importantly, please do take advantage of these services. If you have a question you didn't get to ask or think of a question, call us, and we'll be more than happy to help you. I want to thank you for your participation, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.